And we're recording. Good. Hello, everybody. We're going to get started here in a few minutes. I'm going to give it just a couple of more minutes. I just got a heads up that Brendan Scanlon joined us. Brendan, if you can hear this, I'd like to know who your mom is because I bet I know her. Oh, there you are. No.
This is Brendan.
Hi, Karma. Okay.
I bet you don't. Her name is Claudia. She lives in Miami, Florida.
Oh, no. Then I'm thinking Cassidy Scanlon. Right.
Oh, okay. Yep. Sorry. Thank you, though.
No. Yeah. But no, thanks for that. Okay. So Karma, I'm glad you joined us. Thank you. And
Nice to be here. Thanks.
Yeah. We're looking forward to hearing some of your stories from the Eagle AC. And Dina is on, and Andy Gray and Shane and Al. Hi, Al. So we're going to wait for a few and Chuck's on, Mark. We're going to wait for a few more AC members. Virgil is traveling. He just called me from the airport in California. He's visiting a cousin. He's heading back tonight, so he won't be joining us. We just got off of the Senate Resources hearing, and Virgil testified from California on the Area M issue, and we'll talk about that in just a few minutes. So I just want to say hello, and we'll just give it another minute, and then we'll get started here.
Hey, Gail, do you mind if I give an update on the pike fishery at some point tonight?
Yes, that would be wonderful, Shane. I'd really appreciate that. Thank you. Because that's beginning to be a bit of a more of a big issue. So thank you. All right. So I think we'll go ahead. It's a beautiful night, and I know people want to get out and do stuff. This is our last fishery subcommittee of the season, and we won't be doing any official business. This is more informational. So please jump in when you have questions or anything you'd like to share. I'm kind of going to try to go by the agenda. And if you hear big rumbling, like a freight train, that's the snow coming off my roof. It's right outside my window here. Okay, so John Wiz is on. Good. All right. So I'm going to call the meeting to order at 6:01. And Kyle Campbell is our board support. And this is his last week of work. And I'm jealous because he's going to go riding in the North Slope. So good for you, Kyle. And I'd like to go and introduce some guests very quickly. Karma, do you want to start?
Sure. My name is Karma Albee, or I'm Chief Karma Albee from the Native Village of Eagle. I also work there as the tribal administrator. I'm the chair of the Eagle AC. I'm on the Bycatch Advisory Council, and I also work on the Intertribal Fish Commission. Thanks for having me here.
Yeah, thank you, Chief Karma. You've been doing a great job and appreciate all the work you do. Brandy, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, this is Brendan Scanlon. I'm the Northwest and North Slope Area Biologist. I just wanted to hear some chatter on the Area M issue. That's it. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. And we've got, let's see, number ending in 158. Who is that, please?
Thank you, Gail.
I'm sorry?
Mike Tinker.
Oh, hi. Hi, Mike. Good. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm glad to hear you. So, and Al Barrett from Board of Game. We'll get back to agency people here in just a minute. Mark Richards is on the AC. Chuck Derrick on the AC. Ernie Weiss is with Aleutians East Borough. Ernie, did you want to introduce yourself very quickly?
Oh, thank you, Gail.
Okay. And Jim Simon, good. I'm glad to see you back.
Thanks. Good evening, everyone.
You had a really long weekend. Like the rest of us, we need to coordinate our what's been happening. So with that, we want to get started. The minutes are not done. There's been so much going on. There's literally has been no time to do minutes. I apologize. So we have quite a few minutes that I have to work on over the summer and get to the AC for this fall. Let's see. Real quickly, does anybody want to add something to the agenda? We're going to put Shane Lansbury on there for a Pike update. Okay, any other additions to the agenda? Jim, did you have anything you want to add? Okay. So going on, I'm sorry. Okay. Going on to the Alaska Board of Fisheries action, there was a special meeting on April 19th for Proposal 173, and that was approved by the Board of One. And that was I just had it here a minute ago. And we had a comment on that. So, Jim, did you want to comment on that one at all?
No, I am just learned from you. So
okay.
I was not covering it.
Okay. Mike Tinker sent in some comments, and we sent them in on behalf of the AC in support. And then next item is the Board of Fish NCR deadline, which is August 13th this year. And we'll circle back to that because we will likely be putting in a proposal at that time one of us will put it in, and then it will go to the full AC when they reconvene in October. The Board of Fish work session is October 12th of 13th. And that we were going to put some, consider some proposals for that, but have not done so yet. And Kyle, do you know what the deadline on that one is? I did not look that up. It's 2 weeks before.
Sorry. I just got an email in right now, and I just listen with one ear. You're asking for the ACR deadline or the...
No, the ACR deadline is August 13th. I was asking for the Board of Fish work session. I see Al's got his hand up. Al, do you know that?
Okay, it should be 2 weeks before the meeting, which I had that up because the ACR deadline is 60 days before the work session, and the comment deadline would be 2 weeks before the work session.
Okay, so the end of September. Al, did you have a comment on that?
Well, you made the comment that you were going to submit proposals at the work session. I was wondering how you were going to do that.
For the work session.
For the work session.
Yeah, we would have to do that as individuals, and then it would have to go to the AC later.
What kind of proposals at a work session?
That will come up in a little bit. We'll talk about that in a minute.
Okay.
Thanks, Al.
Yeah.
And I just want to give everybody the dates on this, and then we're going to circle back. Thank you. So the proposal for the joint boards meeting, we don't have any. Oh yeah, well, Chief Alvey's on here from Eagle. Carmen, do you want your proposals that you submitted for the joint boards?
Sure. Hold on just a moment. I'm just pulling it up. So for the joint board proposal that we put in, so we were just asking, we noticed that there was no oral testimony, both in remotely at the Board of Fish. And so we find that's an issue, and we really should be able to testify virtually. And so we put in a proposal, and I sent copies to you, Gail. Of the proposals. I can read it if you want. I'm not sure.
Not unless somebody has a question, but I think the intent, we had decided at our AC meeting not to put one in because we need you and Ninton and Nanana were considering the same thing. So we will be supporting your proposal when that comes up before the board.
Yeah, so basically they allowed the public to provide oral testimony but not remotely, and the high cost of travel, it's very expensive for us to go and stay in Anchorage, and so it would be nice if we could be able to testify on Zoom or on the webinar. So that was that one.
I think you're going to get a lot of support on that.
Good.
And go ahead.
Yeah, and then the other one was just we just did a proposal on Martin that came through from one of the AC members on just extending Martin chopping season by 15 days to align with the closure of lynx chopping regulations in 20E and 25B. I'm not sure if that's your area, so I'm not.
Partially, yes, on the upper
tier. Okay.
Yeah, right.
So it would align state and federal regulations to allow Martin trapping until March 15th. With climate change and prolonged length of spring, Martin are staying prime longer.
If I could interrupt you, Mark Richards is on board, and he is the chair of the board side, and Al's got his hand up too. Al, for you first and then Mark, because I know they'll probably have questions about this proposal. Go ahead, Al.
Yeah, thank you, and thank you, Chief Karma. I'm just curious on your remote testimony for the joint boards. Where does that fit under the call of sections of regulations? What did you submit it under? 96?
Karma, I can probably...
Go ahead, Kyle. Sorry.
I can pull up the... I was helping the AC try to... And I talked with Christy Tibbles a bit to see where that fit in within the call. And I need to open it up in front of me. If you do have that the code there in front of you, Karma, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I think the regulatory side, that was where...
It's 5AAC96.610.
Great, thank you. I was just curious on that one. I know on the board of games side, we've tried to accommodate at least the ACs on that. There's a little bit of resistance to the public doing that.
Okay.
There's resistance from the public, you said?
No, there's resistance on the Board of Games side to allow the public a certain amount of time to testify remotely during a Board of Game meeting.
Oh, sure. I think this is going to be a really good conversation for this joint board, and we need to have that conversation. I just got off of Senate Resources. Listening to the resources hearing, we had 5 testifiers on there. And, there's a way we can do it. We just have to have a plan. And would you agree to that, Al?
Yes, and I mean, recently, since the pandemic anyways, both boards have been operating independently. It appears that the Board of Game is much more... acceptable, at least to having the ACs, due to cost and lodging and logistics, that at least ACs have the opportunity to remote or testify remotely. But there hasn't been that much support for having the general public testify remotely.
I wonder if you couldn't combine those two problems, and I don't want to take any airtime on this right now. I think that's for later. I have a couple of ideas. I'm sure a lot of people do. I think we can make it work. If the issue, after we saw what happened at Ariam and the extreme cost of going down to meetings and with the crisis in the Yukon, it's just getting more and more difficult for people to be able to participate. So it's just like a diminishing returns problem in, you know, and your voice goes away. And I think it's very important to have a really strong voice right now at the Board of Fish for the interior, all the AYK, actually. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, thank you. I agree with Al's assessment of the situation and just wanted to add on that one of the things that I find personally disturbing is that every time this kind of a conversation comes up, the Department of Law points out that the only real legal requirement for public input is through a written comment period that satisfies, checks the boxes, I guess, of compliance with, I don't remember if it's Open Meetings Act or Administrative Procedures Act, but I think the traditions of the public oral presentations during, you know, testimonies during the regulatory meetings is something that we do need to strive to ensure remains in regulation. So thank you, Chief Olby, for Eagle AC, and I apologize for not being able to be there to help.
Gail, this is I just wonder if there's some way that we can use the, I mean, I know there's tribes, but I mean, every, like, tribes are a lot of, like, the rural areas, of course, but, like, you know, the government-to-government relationships that they're supposed to be having with us, you know, so, like, and I don't know, I'm not really sure what I'm trying to ask here, but, I was surprised to see that because there is no government-to-government relationship right now.
You know, Karma, there's a lot of factors in this, and actually it was brought out in Senate Resources today. And I think we need just to sit down and come up with some ideas.
Mm-hmm.
It's the will of the board who can make this decision. They will try to, you know, heavily rely on the law. But they can still go beyond that, as long as they're not violating the law. And, you know, we're seeing so much everywhere of Zoom meetings as being the, methodology for communication. And that's what this is really all about. It's about communicating and it's about having a voice. And so I think, you know, over the summer, you know, we can, a bunch of us can get our heads together just to come up with some pretty good statements as to why this should occur. And if everybody has to come over to an AC meeting to testify all together, maybe that's what has to happen. I don't know. But I just think that this is getting to be more and more critical, especially for the AYK right now. So thank you for doing that. Really appreciate it. And I want to go back to your Martin proposal and just to make sure that Mark Richards has a copy of that. That's what I was trying to get to. Have you seen that, Mark?
Good evening. No, I have not.
Okay, so I will try to get that to you.
I did have a question for Karma, though. Is your proposal just for ACs to be able to testify remotely or for the overall public?
For the overall public, but I know, like, I just was thinking that, you know, like, there is supposed to be government-to-government relationships, but no, for everyone. Like, I would like everyone to be able to testify remotely. I think this last, or one of the last ones that we went to, it was almost like 2 to 3
or $2,000 to $3,000 for the week to stay in Newport.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a noble cause, but I can see the board side of it as well, that, you know, plus the other people that go and do spend money to go there, they'll you know, it's just, it's problematic. It's the same thing with the ACs too, and there's a lot of issues as well as interpersonal. I just noticed it being on the AC, Karma. You know, just if we allow, you know, remote testimony now, it's a lot easier for people to sit at home and not come to the meetings, and it does change things when people aren't there personally, especially behind the scenes when you have conversations during breaks. So I see both sides of it.
And I definitely rather be in person for meetings. I'd much rather be there and in the middle so you can talk with Board of Fish members and stuff. But I'm just an option that we have, be able to have that option if we need to.
Yeah. I've seen it at board game meetings, but does anybody know, we do allow that for AC members, right? Does the Board of Fish also allow ACs to call in?
Not that I know of.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
So, folks, this is Kyle Campbell's board support. And just for everyone's reference to the proposals from the Eagle AC that were adopted or put forward by the AC and submitted, those, I just put a link in the chat. I've actually got those already up on the archive meeting notice from their April 13th meeting. So if you wanted to look at the exact language, they're available there. It's one of the resolutions that I think Karma is going to address here in a moment there as well, and I will upload the other resolutions that just got finalized this week to their archive meeting notice. So if you want to take a look at those there, you can download them from the archive meeting notice from April 13th. And I could also just give one bit of perspective from the board support staff side. We have kind of been tasked last year, this year, with different ways to accommodate that at the will of the board, how to receive remote testimony. So what has worked, at least with the current setup, we've been using kind of the Zoom platform to get the live stream out onto YouTube. So the way we invited remote testimony from both the public and AC members during the Board of Games meetings last year, and then for AC members during the Board of Games meeting this year, was by phone, and where there was no number to call in or to access the meeting, but we would call out to the folks that had sort of signed up to testify remotely. The Board of Fisheries last year did kind of explore for one of their meetings an option for remote testimony where at several different fish and game offices throughout Southeast region, folks could go into a fish and game office and then give their testimony remotely from their local fish and game office during a Board of Fisheries meeting. That one was a bit more challenging on the staffing side to make work, and I think that might be part of why the Board of Fisheries was like, we don't want to do this remote testimony. So I agree it will be really interesting to kind of discussion next year, and I'll be curious to see what the public comment looks like. But we do have at least a couple different, tried practices for making it work from the sort of logistics side of things.
Okay. Thank you for that, Kyle. That's very helpful. Okay, Al, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Gail. My question to Chief Karma, and I didn't catch your last name, so I'm sorry. I'm just using your proper name, your first name. But your Martin proposal, that's not before the joint board, is it? Or is it before the Board of Game?
No, it's before the Board of Game.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted clarification on that.
Okay, and who is Robert's iPhone? You should know that. Robert's iPhone, who is that, please?
Just me.
Oh, okay.
I'm just a member of the public.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for joining us. Al? Your hand's still up. Do you have more comments? Okay.
Sorry about that, Gail.
Okay, so Karma, do you want to go on to your other proposals? And Kyle has linked them. If you go to that link, you can pull them up if you want to look at them.
Yes. So first of all, and I don't, I've been traveling for 2 weeks, so I'm trying to like keep all these documents straight. But so an ichthyophonous resolution we passed, we just, the more and more, I think Andy went to the UConn panel and stuff, and more with the outlook for this year and the amount of salmon that Chinook that crossed, like 12,000. We really, usually the village on my other hatch, we help with the distribution stuff, but the AEC passed the resolution basically asking to stop the ichthyophonous study for this year. And it said all throughout, like down the Yukon, but I'm not sure how much impact that will be, but we passed that and sent that, to ADFNG. And I'm sorry, I don't have that one right in front of me. It's,
I've got it right in front of me, and I want to explain to people what the action is here. Okay. The action is to stop that ichthyophonous testing because it's going to take 800 Chinook out of, and the last, therefore, is, I'll read that to you. The Eagle AC requests that U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and ADFNG postpone the intended studies of ichthyophonous this summer season to avoid the lethal take of 800 extremely critical fish to dangerously depleted spawning grounds. We are going to take action, but I'm in full agreement with this. After listening to a lot of the JCC reports that even if we do find out what's going to be happening with ichthyophonous, there's just some disagreement on the impact that's really having on what we call our ghost fish, our missing fish. But the other side of the coin is, what do you do about it? I mean, there's nothing we really can do about it. So it might be good to know, but we do have quite a bit of information. So it's just the taking of those 800 fish in that fishery right now that is the concern of Eagle AC. And I personally concur with it. If anybody wants to support it, they're certainly welcome to support it. And you sent it to the department and to U.S. Fish and Wildlife also. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So. Yes. So I'll leave that up to personal action, since this is our last meeting, but I will personally support it. And thank you for that, Karma.
Oh, yes.
Does anybody have questions on that particular resolution? Is there anybody from the department that wants to speak to that resolution?
Hi, Gail. Yeah, this is Dina John with Fish and Game. Can you hear me okay?
I can. Thank you.
Yeah, so there is a Zach and Fred aren't able to, I just let them know that you guys are talking, that we're talking about ichthyophonous and see if they want to call in, but there is a response that they're working on, that they're drafting. We do still feel that this research is critically important to understand what's happening to Chinook salmon. And as far as I know so far, the sampling that's going to take place in Pilot and Rapids and Fort Yukon is still going to go ahead this season. It's still kind of in flux. I'm not sure what their response will be, but we do feel that this information is really important to collect in these years, especially when there's no fishing and we're experiencing what's, you know, almost up to half the run not getting where we think that they're going to go. It's really important to try to understand what's happening and why. And so we are, you know, this is really important work that the Fish and Wildlife Service and Fish and Game have really been wrestling with. We do know that the magnitude and the importance of killing Chinook salmon and low runs is really sensitive. We do know that it's a hard ask, but we're really hoping to get some important information. And it's not just ichthyophonous samples that are being taken. It's also samples that are going to support a whole suite of other research projects and endeavors that are trying to understand what's happening to Chinook salmon as they migrate upstream. But I'd be happy if anyone would like to talk to Fred or Zach. I can put their contact information in the chat, and they would be well more suited to speak to that topic than I am.
That was a great thing to do. I do understand it. And in the past, I have supported it. But right now, with such critical numbers, I am leaning toward not supporting that. But I do understand that the project will be going forward. This is more of a statement, I think, of that we need to consider this going forward. But this is only a one-year study. Is that correct?
No, it's multi-year.
Oh, that's right. I forgot that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the goal is to at least do paired sampling between Pilot and Eagle to get at that difference between estimates between those two critical estimation points in the river. That part was, I think, originally planned to be at least 3 years. But going forward, long-term, once we have a model, if we can come up with a predicted model, the samples would ideally just come from Pilot and just be part of the normal mortality that occurs every single year at Pilot Station Sonar. Now, the long-term goal is to come up with an ichthyophonus-based model that will help us know, you know, if we see 60,000 Canadian origin Chinook salmon at Pilot, can we trust that? Can we manage that 60,000 fish as it goes upriver, or do we need to apply some sort of mortality factor to those fish as they go upriver? And so that's the long-term goal, is to come up with a management tool that's going to help us to make better management decisions in the future.
Gail, this is Chuck.
What
numbers of salmon are we talking about their sample?
800.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's at multiple sites, and so be about 180 at each location. And for Pilot Station Sonar, they get about that many mortalities or more. In a normal year, they get more mortalities than that at Pilot Station Sonar as part of the test fish project. And then it'd be 180 samples from Rapids and from Fort Yukon.
Okay, Karma, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, you know, as the chief of the village, we work with ADF&G on the distribution to make sure that everyone gets like a little chunk of fish and that fish is being used and consumed by people. And so we help out with that project. So I just want to reiterate that, like, I'm very supportive of the project, but it's just more and more it's getting to where it's scary that the numbers are so low. And so I think the AC decided that they just, we'd like to, like, take this year and not take those fish in Eagle. And so I just wanted to add that.
Yeah, thank you, Carmen. And that's sort of what tipped the scale for me, too, is that after our meeting in February, we're emphasizing every fish counts, and it really does. And I just got finished writing an article, and I'll tell you about that in a little bit. But it's very scary, and so especially for Chinook. So I appreciate the department's efforts in all this. I really do. And thank you for that clarification, Dina. But did you say, you said multi-year, so what does that mean? Is that 3 or 5 years, or what are you thinking?
Yeah, and so my understanding was that the initial plan was to do at least paired samples between Pilot and Eagle for 3 years. However, last year the sampling was, we stopped sampling partway through the run. We didn't collect as many samples as was originally planned. And so the samples that were collected were towards the front half of the run, so that's not super representative of the whole fish that passed by Eagle. And then, of course, this year without the samples from Eagle, that was a component. I'm not going to say that that's the critical component, is to get samples between Pilot and Eagle, because having upriver samples is still going to tell us a lot. But I think the goal, and again, I'm not the expert on this sampling, was to at least have those paired samples between those two sonar locations for 3 years, and that, you know, and maybe the statisticians and the biometricians who work up that data might be able to come up with a model earlier and discontinue that paired samples. But yeah, that was the goal, I think, was originally for to have it be for 3 years, but then have a tool that we could collect just from Pilot going forward.
Okay. Now that really explains the program, but I guess, like I said, this is more of a statement at this point. So we just all need to be aware, and I know you guys are. You guys on the ground are always aware of this, of protecting those fish. And so, okay, any other questions on this particular subject? And thank you, Carmen, for that. You had one last resolution, I think?
We actually have, like, four more. But so we did a resolution to protect Yukon River Chinook salmon. Basically, Yukon River salmon are extremely critical species for the continuation of cultural practices. Huge drops in the number of Chinook eggs reaching the spawning grounds. We haven't met our escapement goals. There is no outlook for any change in the near future due to the present practices. Despite no fishing for subsistence users or commercial fishermen on the river for 10 years. Now, therefore, be it resolved that we request the National Marine Fisheries Service, NOAA, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to declare Yukon River Chinook salmon a threatened species.
Okay, Tinker, I hear your voice. Go ahead.
Are you waiting?
I am waiting. Go ahead.
Okay, well, the issue of threatened species is totally different. It takes it totally away from Alaska's perspective entirely. If they were to stick that up, then our participation in doing something about a threatened species is gone. So be really careful how you do that. In other words, we have our own classifications within the salmon management plan that allow us to make decisions on whether it's a threatened species in the state. But you don't want to do it under the Endangered Species Act. That would be, in my estimation, that would be a heck of a mistake.
No, so we're not to endangered species yet. That's what, like, I'm pretty sure threatened species is a step before that. And basically just declaring that it's a threatened species. We're not quite to the endangered species yet.
I think the issue, and this is on the federal side, on the state side, Mike is totally correct, but our Chinook is still under a stock of concern under a yield level, which is the lowest level, and we've been trying to get it bumped up to management concern, because the issue is, and somebody from the department correct me if I'm wrong, that it is a different level of management of how you deal with the fishery. So does that make sense, Dina?
Yeah, and it would be really interesting to see how that plays out, how an endangered species is going to play out. I don't know what the ramifications of that would be. We have, you know, escapement goals, and that's what we manage for. There's a lot of work that goes into getting those escapement goals, what the numbers should be, and then managing towards those escapement goals for long-term sustainability. So having an Endangered Species Act listing would really change, I think, how we do things, but I don't know exactly how it would change how we do things.
Well, we have a lot of different opinions on this, and they're not talking ESA, they're talking threatened. I think the issue is really just to bring it to everybody's attention. My question to you was, what would the department do differently if the stock of concern was up from a yield concern to a management concern? What would happen in terms of management? Because I think already you're doing a lot of the things that are at that level. Is that correct?
Yeah, like everything that we're doing now in terms of our management actions we're fully closing fisheries to meet escapement goals. And so,
right.
Yeah, but at this point, there aren't any more management actions I can take in river in season aside from, like, completely closing fishing for non-salmon and taking all gear out of the water, which we really don't want to do. So yeah, we're managing as conservatively as we can with the tools that we have. I don't know what more tools I could be given to work with in season more than that, you know, that we're already been using.
Right. So that was my question. So if we stay at a yield concern, it won't make any difference. You're doing everything you can already with the toolbox. So, but I think being that this is a federal side issue, it will be handled differently. And I think they're all aware of the problem. And I think it's just another layer of, you know, the concern that people have on a river. That's really what it is. It's a statement. Carmen, am I correct in that interpretation?
Yes. I think it's just to bring awareness to the situation more than anything at this point. I think the last would be to go into endangered species, but this is just, I guess, you know, Don is the one that wrote this up, and the AC passed it fully, but basically just calling it a threatened species, bringing awareness to the situation, which everyone's aware, of course, but...
Yeah, right. We're all looking for a way to express this frustration of, you know, because it's such a dire situation. So, you know, it's just another outlet at this point, particular point. And I do agree with Mike Tinker that we really don't want to go to an ASA listing because that opens up such a can of worms for everybody and will shut down things that we don't want to shut down, just as Dana was talking about. So we do have to be careful with it. But I'm my heart's aligned with the expression. Thank you very much, Karma. Al, you've had your hand up for a long time.
Thank you, Gail. I don't even think you want to consider threatened species under the federal regime. You know, you're looking at it just from a fishing standpoint. You go into threatened or endangered species, you're talking about a watershed. And that could mean you're not allowed to boat up to your favorite moose camps in the fall time because the riverboat traffic may be a harm to the, you know, the fry that are in that river. So you're opening up a lot of things that a lot of people don't understand. And when you start talking about a watershed, because that's what you're going to be looking at if you go to threatened or endangered, it's just not, you know, drainages, but an entire watersheds. And it may impact you more than you realize.
I think you're totally correct. I think what would be very helpful for a lot of people, because I hear this frustration up and down the river, is maybe for us to get some kind of a work paper out on this as to what all of these things might mean, because that would help people to better understand what the implications are for each level. Jim, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. Chief Alvey, could you remind me, did you say that letter regarding the considering the salmon threatened, was that sent to the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council? Is that what you had said?
Request the National Marine Fisheries Service, NOAA, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
And all but the resolution dealing with ichthyophonus, I think were just finalized earlier today. And so I'll get those sent out. I'm sending them to Executive Director Art Nelson as we speak, and we'll get those distributed to the right recipients tomorrow. But they have not yet been delivered. They just were finalized.
Okay. Thank you, Kyle. Jim, did you have another comment?
No, sorry, I forgot to lower my hand.
No, that's okay. Just want to make sure. Karma, thank you very much. We all share in that frustration, whether it's the resolution, you know, on both resolutions. And mm-hmm. It's just a matter of what is the best course of action. And that is always very complicated. We're going to be talking about that again here very shortly in another venue. But
real quick, I just want to touch, we don't have to go through these, but there's another resolution we did, State of Alaska Reduction of Pink and Chum Salmon Hatchery Output.
Oh, thank you for bringing that up. I saw that. Thank you.
Yes, and there's another federal non-funding of additional hatcheries in Alaska. And the third one is request U.S. State Department to bring topic of hatchery production by Pacific Rim countries to reduce output. So those are the three. You have copies of them. Your AC.
I have them right in front of me, yeah. And you can all you can get them online. And now you're talking our language. So
yeah.
Yeah, those are very good, by the way, just briefly looking at them. And I will talk about them again here in a minute because that leads into another discussion. But thank you for that. And, yeah, thank you for joining us tonight. I talked to, Kirk Schwalm the other day, who was former chair of the Fairbanks AC, and he said he'd been hearing how wonderful it is that ACs are starting to talk with each other a lot more up and down the river, which I consider, are a huge plus too. And the only thing I can think of that really helped facilitate that was, the ability to hold a lot of Zoom meetings so that we can have better communication. So that's been
really yeah. Well, we really appreciate your guys' support when, some of the things that we talk about and stuff, and, we're always willing to work with you guys to, help our voices be stronger in the future. So thank you so much for having me here tonight. And, I probably won't stay on, all through the meeting, but I really appreciate it.
Yes. Well, thank you for joining us. Okay.
Yeah, thank you, Cameron.
Any other questions for Carmen before we go on to the next? Okay. So the next information is the Board of Fish, Cook Inlet, and Kodiak proposals were due April 10th. And the AC did put proposals in for reducing egg production to 25% of the 2000 levels. And require odorless marking. And that goes along the lines of what you were just talking about, Karma. And we did get those submitted on time. So they're in the process. And I'm sure that will be a very lively conversation when they come up at the board meeting. Next, we're going to go on to the Alaska State Legislature. Current fisheries is where the real action is happening right now. And as all of you know, Senator Donnie Olson introduced Senate Bill 128, and Mike Cronk introduced a House companion for House Bill. He's got two out, and it went right in my head what number that is. Kyle, do you know off the top of your head?
I think it's House Bill 180.
Yeah, I think you're right. Let me look it up for sure. But anyway, it's a companion bill to the Senate bill. And that particular, the Senate, both those bills, do want to shut down AM fishing in the entire area for that June fishery. There has been some hearings on them. There was a, Senate Judiciary hearing, and there was a Senate Resources informational meeting on Friday and another one today. And there was Chief Brian Ridley spoke at that hearing today. And then there were two people from Area M, Kylie Thompson from the Area M Singers and Francis Leach representing USA in relationship and Alicia East Borough. It probably won't get a lot of traction this session, but go into the next year. It's raising a lot of, level of conversation, which is what we desperately have needed. And, there's a lot of pushback from some legislators saying that it interferes with the legislature's role in with the Board of Fish, but this is a special circumstance, and this is the way we're presenting it. And the situation is so critical that you cannot get to the heart of this issue at a board meeting. And it's not the responsibility of the board to do that, very frankly. They have to decide on a particular fishery, but not on the whole ecosystem's understanding of what's going on. there are a lot of our testifiers that were at that area and meeting that objected to the lateness of receiving those genetics reports, and that they hadn't been peer-reviewed. There's some, there is truth in that, but it's not to denigrate the work of the geneticist, but it is to say that there's a process issue here. And also we heard from Dr. Schindler and others that even though those particular genetic studies said that only 6% of the area M Chum intercept went into the Yukon River, that's a pretty big significant number when you start translating it. So what's happening right now is in 2021, there was a huge number of Chum intercepted, and you guys have seen those figures before. And then in 2022, the fleet, looking at their numbers and working with the department, said, okay, we need to do something about this, and they came up with a voluntary adaptive management plan. And that was voluntary in 2022, and they offered that as a resolution to the board meeting at Area M for finalizing. And everybody remember that any decision on Area M is not in-season management, it's a three-year management plan. And so we, the Interior, of course, we were supporting proposal number 140, which would have shut down the fleet in specific windows to allow for more Chum passage. And the result is that that proposal that was supported by the board under RC 190, and supported by four members of the board, came up to only 12% reduction in the status quo, whereas 140 would have been 60% reduction. There's a lot in this that is coming out, but there's so much that is so hard to do in sound bites. We can't do this in sound bites. We need a really good, hard look at what's happening with that intercept fishery. And one of the things that Chief Ridley brought today and Virgil brought up in testimony was that Area M fishermen have options that we don't have in the AYK. We have none. Our fishing is pretty much shut down all over the AYK, or it's so greatly reduced. And that includes subsistence. It includes personal use, subsistence, sports, and commercial fishing shut down a long time ago. So it's a dire condition for up here. I think the legislators are starting to understand that a little bit more. We need to educate a lot of the legislators. And Senator Bishop asked a lot of good questions, and some of the other, and Senator Kawasaki, some of the other legislators did as well. I think they're all trying to thread this needle and figure out what to do. But it's not something we're going to resolve in a short period of time. We just need a long-term plan on this. And Alex, you've got your hand up. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Gail. I think the biggest point, and the commercial guys were really hitting on it, they kept saying we volunteered, we self-restricted ourselves. And that's not totally true, because if you listen to the commissioners on the record comments to the Board of Fish when Proposal 140 was up there, and I think Jim Simon read the transcripts and may be able to verify it, it was the commissioner himself going to the Area M fishermen and saying, you need to do something, and you need to do it this year, because you have a Board of Fish in cycle coming up for Area M, and if you can't show that you've been restricting yourselves, it's not going to be favorable in your defense. And so that's when you heard them today, 2022 or 2021, we self-restricted ourselves. It was only by the commissioner telling them that if you don't do something, it could be ugly for you. And maybe Jim can confirm that.
No, I heard that too, Al, too, and hadn't gotten to that point, but that is an extremely good point. So it was 2021 was such a high year. In that June fishery in particular, they caught over a million some chum as intercepts. And it was such a stunning number. So the department warned them. They got their crew together and said, okay, we got this meeting coming up. I mean, I was a fisherman for 20 years. I know exactly how these things work. And so I have to applaud them for doing that. But the thing is, we're after severe restriction on that area and harvest. And even the harvest numbers for 2022 were significantly high for that gin fishery. I think there were 500 and something. Jim, correct me if I'm wrong. I have so many numbers in my head right now. So the question is, oh, thank you. The question is that, we have an inherent distrust of the genetics in terms of interpretation and time and area. That hasn't been satisfactorily explained to us. I know the two geneticists. I think they're very, very highly recommended, and that's not the issue. The issue is, did they follow the WASIP studies? My understanding is that they did not follow the WASIP sampling areas. And did they get this peer review? No, they didn't get a peer review. So there's just a level of confusion and answers that we can't get to. So we're trying to say, look, we've got to have better genetics, and we've got to have a better understanding of the numbers of that go into the AYK, but it doesn't even matter. Dr. Schindler said very clearly that when numbers are so bad in the AYK, that percentage is very significant, probably more so than in abundance. And I'm going to stop right there. And Al, did you have one more comment before we go to Jim?
No, I'll let Jim go.
Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, thank you, Gail. I think you summed that up very well. And also what Dr. Schindler has pointed out is why caps or triggers don't really work either, unless they're tied to levels of abundance of chum salmon. Because as he has recently said, you know, taking even 500, I don't remember what number he said, but hundreds of thousands of chum, when there's a million, you know, coming up the Anvik River, you know, that's probably not a big deal. But when we have only 19,000 going up the Anvik River, that has a 300,000 goal, if I remember correctly, you know, then that's a problem, that kind of trigger. And, yeah, so that's the only thing I would add on right now. And, you know, it's, as I've learned from Virgil, you know, the only time you can tell they're lying is when their lips are flapping. You know, I did hear, people tell me one-on-one during the Area M meeting that there were three boats that didn't sign in to the voluntary aspect. So it's just a numbers game and alternative facts being used by those who are defending their multi-million-dollar fishery.
Yeah, and that is a good point. It's a multi-million-dollar fishery, and not all of those participants are local area residents. Some are Alaskan residents, but non-local, and a significant portion of the fleet is an outside. And I have to say, if you look at the quartiles for who makes the most money, it's the outside fleet that makes the top dollars, and because they have those great big same boats. And the commissioner did say on Friday that when asked, he said that the fleet in the last 15 years has increased 2 to 3 times in capacity compared to what those boats used to be able to carry before and able to harvest. So we've got a very efficient boat that can stay out at sea for long periods of time and make very significant amounts of money in their sockeye, and nobody's begrudging them that. But that intercept fishery, just like in the Bering Sea with the trawl fleet, is costing the AYK. It's costing us. And it's not just costing us the loss of our fish. It's costing us the future of the fish, because the numbers that I keep getting, and the department can correct me, but the numbers I keep getting are very dire, particularly with Chinook, not recoverable in some of our streams. The gene is a good example. So I think our issue is that we have to look at, we've said this many times before, what is it we can, as humans, can do? We can't do anything about the environment, but we can do a lot in terms of protecting our spawning beds, and we can certainly do a lot in terms of intercept and bycatch. And it's been going on for years and years and years. And if it were low abundance years, high abundance rather, we don't notice it that much. But now we do. So, and now it's critical mass because we could lose entire species, discrete stuff. And that's really what the issue is all about. And I heard Flick Bishop say today to the Area M folks, to everybody, that, you know, you could very well be in the position we're in just a few years, because you're, aside from the Asian stock, you're fishing out stock that is going to spawning beds. So the Asian stock aside, which is a significant number, and they have markers to separate them out, but for the CWAC, the Central Western Alaskan stocks, we've got to get those statement numbers up everywhere. And Al, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Gail. One other thing on that, I heard in the testimony today that, and I forget the department's person that was part of the Yukon there, that warming waters was detrimental to the chum salmon spawning in a certain year or two. And that I was wondering, was that documented in any other river or drainage?
No, that was 2019 on the Koyukuk, and it was a low water year. And there are die-offs in low water years, and it did go around the world, but it wasn't. It was an aberration in some respects, and it was not directly related to this issue. I mean, it was just one year that we had that die-off, there are, there's a lot we don't know. I mean, like Dino was saying earlier, there's a lot we don't know about fish as they go up the river and what is affecting them. We have our theories. But on that particular year, and is there anybody in the department that wants to comment on that?
Yeah, sorry, Gail, apologies, my internet. Yeah, it's terribly slow. And I thought there were other die-offs observed in 2019. Like, I thought there were fish observed in other parts of Western Alaska. Of course, I can't pull up anything to verify that. But, yeah, it is really disconcerting. It was really disconcerting to see those fish that died off in 2019. We did have escapement that year that was above the 1.2 million, so it's hard to say what percentage of those fish that did escape were successful. And I think we're really going to see that this year, because this is when we'll start getting the age fours back from 2019. So we'll be, looking at the age of the fish, the summer chum, as they come in at Lower Yukon, and just seeing how many fish it looks like were able to successfully come out of that year. It is really concerning. And then also, I didn't hear the testimony on Friday, so I don't know who spoke, but there are a lot of concerns for ocean conditions and warm water in the ocean, especially in that really, really critical time when fish are just hitting salt water and just, needing to get all their marine food and encountering all the environment out there that may be different than what they would normally be swimming into.
Yeah, correct. That's more reef, right, to more fish to the fires if we can. Yeah, thank you, Dina.
Just one other thing is, we just seen it on one, watershed. I mean, like, if the weather and the warm weather was such a concern, did we see that, like, in northern Canadian provinces or any other drainage outside the Yukon or Kuskokwim?
I think there were some small rivers that I heard the Canadians talk about but not that kind of die-off. And there again, we'd have to look into it. And Dina thought there was maybe some other areas, which there might have been. I only know about the Koyukuk. It will be interesting this year because that particular problem did not happen in the Chena, but we're going to see what happens on the returns for these four-year-olds coming back. There's a lot there that's unknown, Alan. I think we need to kind of start ferreting out those things.
It just kind of persuades or kind of puts that mindset into those legislators that are thinking about this, that you know, one, they're blaming it on warm water, but that's not inconclusive. And two, that the commercial fleet voluntarily, quotes in air quotes there, we're trying to take this under control ourselves, and we don't need to be regulated.
This is true. And to me, all of this talk is a diversionary tactic. We can't do anything about the environment. We can do some little things, and we can do some habitat protections and things like that. And there's a long list that I just prepared in this article I just finished. But there is what we can do on the big end side is curtail both intercept and bycatch. Those are the two big things that we can do. And in that, there again, it goes to every fish counts. We all know how resilient salmon are. We've seen some dire conditions many times before in the last 50, 100 years. But right now they're so low, and they've been so low for so long, that losing those discrete stock is the real question. So we really need to work seriously on protective measures. And we need to reduce hatchery protection. I don't know what we're going to do in the Bering Sea because it's Asian hatcheries, but I have a thought, and I'm not going to say it out loud until I can make it sound intelligent. Brandon, you had your hand up a while ago. Do you have a comment you want to make?
Oh, hi, thanks. I just added a comment to the chat about another large die-off we had on the Kobuk River in 2014.
Right.
It was chum salmon. It was sheafish. It was all the way up and down the drainage. But the chum salmon up there are five-year fish. And in 2019, when we would expect to see some kind of recruitment failure in terms of fish coming back, we had a pretty big return and a pretty large harvest in the commercial fishery. So,
oh, that's encouraging. I like good. Yeah. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, and I used to live in the Kobuk, but not during that time period. But I have friends that still live up there. And was that a particularly low water year?
It was a very warm year. At one point, the water 4 feet down below Cayena was 70 degrees.
Yeah, I have been fishing sheafish at Cayena in that warm water. It is like a bathtub. You're in the river, and it is really warm.
Yeah. It's really spooky. We do have some evidence that the sheafish, at least, will duck into the cold water trips on their way up to the spawning grounds. So just kind of park there and breathe. So we get some rain. We saw large groups of them in a hunt in the Salmon River, just the lower half mile or so, where the water was a whole lot cooler. So they seem to have figured it out or have a plan. Thanks.
Thanks for that comment. And I'm glad to hear that you had a successful follow-up here on that year class. That's great. Okay. There's a lot I could talk about on the Area M issue. There's a whole group of us, as most of you know, in the Bristol Bay AYK area, and we'll be working through the summer and working on doing a lot of research and getting some more facts together. But and hopefully for the next legislative season, it's a matter of educating all of us, not just legislators, but all of us are in an area that we need to be more and more educated in terms of protecting salmon and certainly helping our local folks, agency folks, in their efforts. So before we move on, is there anybody who wants to make another comment on that? Al, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. So, you know, this proposal, this bill that's in front of the legislature, you know, ask for action this year. So if it doesn't make it through this legislative session, is it able to go through to the second session?
As far as I know, yes.
Yes.
Because it's asking for this June, not next June.
Mike, go ahead.
It'll be automatically carried forward unless final action is taken on it, or unless it goes into a committee that refuses to move it at all, as some fisheries have in past years. So, you know, this is one of those things where we just watch and see how far it gets. And then I would say, to answer Adam's question, the only option then is some type of emergency action by the department to ensure to ensure passage through there and escapement, and that's pretty marginal in my mind.
Right. We had talked about that at a previous safety, and we're like, they could do that as an individual. I don't expect to get a lot of traction with that, but then there's other things that we can do going forward. But this season may be just to see and wait what happens with the prosecution of that fishery. I think everybody's going to be on their best behavior for this year, but I do want to remind people that it's a three-year management plan. And I worry about how the thing's going to hold together. But it is not a voluntary, it is a mandatory plan right now. That was explained today in the hearing that plan is among the three processors. The fisherman has to sign an agreement with one of the processors in order to sell their fish to anybody. So it is a mandatory plan in that sense. But there's a lot of unknowns there. I don't want to take up airtime tonight on that. And hopefully, as we go along, we can keep people informed as to what we find out. I think just more lend, light on what's happening, with that fishery and been a long day, and relativity to the, AYK is, we're getting a lot of people's attention. Then we should have had this attention on it 20, 25 years ago, and which Virgil had tried to do. But so I think that that we'll move on from that discussion unless anybody has any last minute comments that they want to make. Okay. That going on to SB 129, which is introduced by Representative Kronk, and that is just a remake of the old Tellerico bill, if any of you remember that, on stream site enhancement. We don't have the bandwidth right now to make comment on that, but I just want to say that I was opposed to it the first time around with Tellerico because there's no enforcement for that kind of bill, and it really doesn't. I talked to a lot of scientists on this, and there's really no way to figure. It's a feel good sort of situation, but it's not something that you can monitor very easily. And the concern would be that you have to take eggs out of the environment to put back in for the broodstock. And it's different than for hatchery because on the stream side enhancement bill, it's just you just do it direct into the water. You're not going through the amorphing of the hatchery genetics, which is a real concern for wild stock. So it would be the same broodstock theoretically, but if a person is frustrated and says, okay, I'm going to go get some eggs from Ship Creek, well, then you're introducing a non-local stock, which is illegal, but nobody is going to be able to enforce that. And that's just off the top of my head, the conversation we had under the Tellerico bill. And I would like to hear if there's anybody in the department that, because as I remember, the department was against that last time, but I'd like to hear, or maybe they were neutral, I don't remember. I'd have to go back and look. But is there anybody in the department that has some knowledge of that?
So,
Al, go ahead.
Yeah, did you get a chance to listen to that committee hearing?
No, I did not.
So I listened in on that committee hearing, and, I'm with you on that. But the sentiment or the committee hearing, I didn't hear any opposition, and, in fact, it sounded like they were more in support of it than they were opposing it.
I think that is a educational issue, but Senator Bishop did ask Virgil today what people in the interior generally thought, and we had opposed it last time. So he said, "No, I don't think he would change our opinion."
I heard that. So that was encouraging. But on the House side, in that committee hearing, there was no opposition to. In fact, they were kind of giddy about doing this bucket hatchery deal, and we're looking for the future of it.
Well, everybody's looking for relief. That's what we're all doing. That it's just that are you going to do more harm than good? That's what it came down to.
And nobody talked about that.
No. So that's what I'm saying. It's a matter of education. And I think I just don't have time to engage in that right now. I would like to talk to Representative Cross. I do know that he is the personal friend of Dave Tallarico, so that probably is that connection. But
he is absolutely supporting it.
Yeah.
And so was our Representative Vance.
Yes, yeah, and I remember you saying that. So I think we've got to just do a little more homework on that one, and even among ourselves. Mike, you want to put it real quick? Mike, did you want to say something?
No, you're good.
Okay. All right, Jim.
Yeah, thanks. Just quickly, having been involved in the Arctic Yukon Kuskokwim Sustainable Salmon Initiative since it basically started for about 10 years or so, that Gail also served on, the National Academy of Sciences, the National Research Council, was commissioned to provide recommendations and guidance on the development of the AYK Research and Restoration Salmon Research and Restoration Program. And the first thing that they said, because it was for a research and restoration program, was restoration needs to be approached very cautiously, because if you don't understand the dynamics that are causing your current declines by enhancing or hatchery fish in particular, you could really end up furthering the damage rather than helping.
Well said. Thank you, Jim. That's a good segue, and I just finished up an article that's going to come out in the Yurtfa newsletter. It's pretty lengthy. Did a lot of homework with a lot of scientists on this, on why having a large-scale hatchery, anadromous hatchery on the Yukon is a very bad idea. And that always goes back to the impact on the wild stock. That's what it really comes down to. You're going to exacerbate a problem that we already have. And so I don't want to get into too much of a discussion of that. I'll let that article come out. We can have that discussion. And we, at our AC level, we've been talking about doing that for a while, and we really do need to have that discussion. But tonight probably isn't the time for it. But in general, we have been opposed to those large-scale hatcheries because of the damage they've done to wild ducks in both the Gulf of Alaska and Bering Sea. And it's an issue that is being debated all over the Pacific Northwest. And here's what normally happens. In the Pacific Northwest, they've had to do it because they've had a lot of obstacles that we don't have. They've had dams and roads and all kinds of obstacles, barriers for fish. And so they've been trying to compensate with hatcheries for years. They work fairly well for about 15 years. And then because the genetics deteriorate in hatchery fish so badly, they start going down very quickly. Hatchery fish do not have the same level. They start out as strong juveniles, but then over time they lose their genetic ability to survive more in the wild like wild fish do. But at the same token, a lot of hatcheries they understand this. So what they do is they get more broodstock from their wild stock, and they have to continually replenish that broodstock. Well, we're in a down cycle. Where are we going to get that broodstock from? There's no place, and that's the same problem with the bucket builders. There's no place to get eggs from without damaging the existing wild stock even further. We just have to help them with their habitat and passage and everything, just so they can do their magic and get to the spawning grounds. Anyway, I'm going to get my high horse about that again, and I don't want to do that. So that's on that stream side enhancement, though I don't expect that to get out of the legislature this year. Al, I don't know if you have any more insight on that, but I suspect with very little time left that will be a bill that carries over to the next session. Is that your interpretation?
Yeah, no, Gail, I was just, you know, I was just pointing out that from either side of the political parties, there was no opposition to, you know, moving that bill forward. But, you know, I don't see it that late in this, that late in this session.
Yeah, yeah. That's interesting. Thank you for that, Al. That would be a good thing for the AYSA group to monitor over the next few weeks. Okay, we also have the board confirmation hearings. The first ones were April 14th, and all the appointees got through those hearings. There's going to be the joint House-Senate confirmation hearing, the final one, which has not been scheduled yet, as I understand. Is that correct, Kyle? Kyle, did we lose you? Okay.
I thought we were talking to Kyle. What was the question?
The question was that the confirmation hearings for the joint Senate House have not been scheduled yet.
No, but every the Board of Gaming and the Board of Fish have all gone through their hearings.
Right.
And so, yeah, so I expect in the next couple of weeks, because there's only, less than 20 days left in the session, that, you know, something will be scheduled.
Right. So we'll just watch for it. I don't expect there to be a lot of controversy, actually.
I haven't heard. It was no questions asked in either the Board of Fish or the Board of Game side.
That's eerie. That's really eerie.
It's nice if you're an appointee.
Yeah, exactly. Right, no kidding.
Well, Gail, so, I think I'll have a better answer for you than I would. Sorry, I've got two different mute buttons. I've got to hit them both, and I was talking to a dead speaker.
Okay. I knew you were in there somewhere. Okay, so we're just waiting to get that, and I'll send out when I hear. Or maybe if you hear before me, you guys and I can send it out to the AC members so they have a heads up on that if they want to listen. Okay, and then that would be a good opportunity to get to know the three new appointees. We already know Jared Godfrey from Kodiak. I've known his family forever and ever. But the two other appointees we don't know very well, and it'd be nice to just hear them talk about themselves a little bit. And then Stan, of course, we all know. The other news is that Israel Payton, who was on the Board of Fish for a very long time, has just been hired as the Sports Fish Director, which I think personally is a good thing. He doesn't have a biology background, I don't think, but he's really knowledgeable. He was very knowledgeable on the Board of Fish, really a nice guy. Is there anybody in the department that wants to pipe up on that? Okay, and that brings us to, we'll do the preseason summary that Gina was going to give us quickly, and then, which is very discouraging, so it won't go very long, but, and then Shane was going to talk about the Pike update. So, Gina, you're on.
Yeah, Gail, I think I might have given a brief summary of our outlook strategies at a previous meeting, but I can just run through them real quick. It was kind of a recap of what we presented at the Yurtfa preseason meeting, is that this year we expect to have low numbers of Chinook salmon. The drainage-wide forecast is for a run between 62,000 to 104,000 fish, and what we've seen is that runs below 150,000 fish tend not to meet our statement goals in Alaska or Canada, and the Canadian origin Chinook salmon run is between 26,000 to 43,000 fish. And the escapement goal at the U.S.-Canada border is at least 42,500 fish, so the run is likely to be below escapement goals and have no fish available for harvest for Chinook salmon. For summer chum salmon, we have an outlook range of between 280,000 to 900,000 fish, and the point estimate of that is around 557,000 fish. So there's a lot of uncertainty around this forecast, in part due to the 2019 hot water temperatures that I mentioned earlier. And, of course, because the Chinook and chum come in at the same time, we're going to be really needing to protect Chinook salmon, even if there are enough summer chum salmon over the lower end of the drainage-wide escapement goal to allow fishing on chum salmon. We would most likely be starting with selective gear types with the release of king salmon required And if there are any opportunities for gillnets for chum salmon, it would likely come really late in the run after the majority of Chinook salmon have gone through. And so our management planning, it'll look a lot similar to last year. Just maintain openings for non-salmon gear. There's been an expansion of areas of the river where you can use hook and line for subsistence. So you can use hook and line up past the New Lotto River, up through District 5. You still need a sport fish license in District 6 and the Dahl River, and there's closed waters along the highways where you can't use hook and line for subsistence. But we can require the release of salmon from hook and line by emergency order, so we'll likely have an emergency order requiring the release of Chinook salmon and chum salmon, unless chum salmon numbers are above the drainage wide escapement goal. Yeah, and things should look pretty pretty much the same for non-salmon, all the usual non-salmon gears, 4-inch or smaller mesh gillnets. You won't see a change up in the upper river where folks already had to use set nets, but we will be requiring that those 4-inch nets be operated as set gillnets so they can't be drifted. I don't think that a lot of people did, but that's a new regulatory change that we have. Yeah, and all of this will be summarized and sent out in the Outlook flyer that we will be mailing out here shortly, probably within the next week or so, and it'll also get published as an advisory announcement. And I see a question for Al. Do you need a license to hook and line for subsistence? So if you're in a permit area where a permit is required, so up near the Yukon River Bridge and up by Stevens and up by Eagle, you would need a subsistence permit. But if you're fishing in, like, the New Lotto River or the Kaikuk River or near Galena, it's just another allowable gear for subsistence fishing.
Okay, great.
Yeah, Gail, I have a question.
Go ahead, Mike.
The report is great as far as the number of fish expected coming in and all that. I think this is one of those years where we're going to have to really be and not forget about doing everything we can to monitor how these fish are moving when they actually get in the river. In other words, we're going to need to be looking at rivers like the Salsha and Chena, and some of the smaller ones, and I kind of like the department to, you know, continue that commitment. We haven't really talked about it yet, but I truly not like to see them back off of the energy they put into counting and looking for them in the various smaller creeks, just because we predict a lower number coming in.
Yeah, thanks for that comment. Yeah, so we do plan to operate all of our typical projects, so that includes the Lower Yukon test fishery. We do have a change at that project where we're not going to be operating our set gill net. We typically operate a set gill net for Chinook salmon. We're not going to operate that this year to reduce king salmon mortalities. We will be operating the drift gill nets for summer chum and Chinook out of the Lower Yukon test fishery. So we'll be getting information on run timing and also summer chum salmon ages. There'll be the pilot station sonar, the Andrea C. Weir, Anvik sonar, Gasasa and Henshaw operate, and then the ichthyofauna sampling at near the rapids and up at Fort Yukon, and then the Chena and the Salcha towers, and of course also Eagle sonar. And then we additionally fly aerial surveys later in the summer to try to count summer chum and kings and a bunch of other streams that we have aerial survey historical counts going back in time for. And then also this year there is going to be a radio telemetry project where up to 500 radio tags are going to be implanted in Chinook salmon near Imonic. And then those fish will be heading upriver, and so they'll be going by towers along the riverbank, and then there's also going to be aerial surveys later on in the fall to try to track down where those tags end up.
Oh, that's great.
That's absolutely great. That's just what I wanted to hear you say.
Yeah, because it needs
to be part of the discussion. But the only thing I would advise is that you not give Al any of the frequencies that will be in the radio telemetry study.
If anybody's got any more questions about the radio tagging, they should definitely reach out to Josh Clark. If you want a frequencies, if you find a fish, we'll be putting out flyers and posters and talking about it on the Yerba teleconferences. And we talked a little bit about it the Yerba pre-season call. We definitely want people to turn tags back in. If they get a king in their gear and they're able to release it alive, it would be great if they could send us a picture of the pink spaghetti tag from behind the dorsal fin. And of course, if you find a fish that has expired, you know, if it's you find it in a log jam or on a gravel bar, or if it's something that happened to got incidentally harvested in non-salmon gear, we definitely would like to get those tags back because they can be refurbished and reprogrammed for next season.
Great. Yeah, we should. Are you going to get a flyer out to everybody, and we can circulate it among our crew and get it to the AYK group downriver? You'll be doing that to all the villages?
Yeah, they'll get mailed out. Yeah, Josh is in. He's heading up all that. He'll be sending it to tribal councils and post offices and all that, and we'll talk about it on the air for calls. We'll mention it in our weekly updates and all that. So.
Good. No, that's real exciting. Thank you, Dina. Good.
And one other aspect of that is that they are doing genetics from those fish, and so they'll get individual assignment. So each of those fish will know, not real time, but we'll know, that tag number 27 was Canadian origin, and then we'll get to see if that fish goes to Canada or doesn't do that.
Right.
So this also helps. This will help to inform the en route mortality. It'll just be really great to see how these fish are making it up river.
No, that's a good point. Thank you very much. That's a very good point. Al?
Yeah, I was just, I heard Virgil the other day, and then I was in his office talking to him. So he was saying there was another sonar check between Pilot Station and Eagle. So it's really a telemetry operation that's going on and not a sonar check.
Yeah, so TCC is working on a mid-river sonar this year. They've got a biologist, Brian Lepping. Well, Brian McKenna and then Brian Lepping. So they've got two Brians. So yeah. Brian Lepping is going to be going out to Pilot Station Sonar for some time this summer. He's going to get to watch the operations out there, get to watch, and observe and ask Carl Fisher and the rest of the sonar crew a ton of questions. And then they've really got a big task ahead of them when they start doing their site selection. It's going to, they're really going to have to put a lot of work into that to figure out what's going to be the best place to put it. If they want to put it above the Tanana, below the Tanana, what's going to have suitable bank, what's going to have a great place for a camp. So they've got a lot of work ahead of them.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah. And Chris Bye just said he's going to be on the lookout for the Chena and the Salcha, which is good. Yeah. That's great. Thank you. So any other questions for Dina before we go on to Pike?
And I can just briefly say that for fall chum, one of our best indicators for fall chum is how the summer chum salmon run goes.
Right.
So there is an outlook for fall chum, which I can pull up here really quickly. The fall chum salmon outlook is for a run of for a run of 251,000 fish with a range of 112 to 602,000 fish. So kind of similarly, the summer chum salmon, the midpoint of that range is real close to the lower end of the drainage wide escapement goal. But if these runs come in at the upper end of the forecast, then we hope that there will be a harvestable surplus for fall chum and summer chum.
Oh, okay.
But we'll know more about fall chum once we see how the summer chum run shakes out. So in July, we'll get a much better forecast, a mid-season forecast.
And that will be with six-inch mesh?
Yes. Well, our selective gear, we're also going to want to be looking at the timing of Chinook salmon. So if there are some late migrating Chinook salmon coming through, I'll be coordinating with Christy to see if it's appropriate to not have selective gear. And then she's also got to be managing for the Canadian goals.
Right.
And so if it looks like some rivers like the Porcupine, Tadrinjik are not doing well, then those spawning tributaries may be closed. Or alternately, she may need to close the main stem if she's trying to protect Canadian escapement. But those will all be questions you guys can ask Christy in season or during the year for calls or as we get closer towards the fall season.
Oh, great. Wonderful. Question for Jim. Do you know if Brian McKenna is going to be doing some more work on the Black River area? I know he was trying to expand a little bit.
I do not know the answer to that question. I apologize.
No, that's okay. I'm just curious. Yeah. Okay. Well, Dina, thank you very much for that. Appreciate it. Appreciate your work. And Shane, are you still online, sir?
Yep, I'm here, Gail. And I guess just to add on real quick too. So, and just a reminder, I don't know if we've already told you guys or not, but the coho can is also anticipated to be low average, where average is 222,000 fish.
Thank you for that. I was going to ask. Thank you. Yeah.
But yeah, so I just had a quick update for pike. So the pike fishery in the Chattanooga harvest area is winding up. As a reminder, that fishery closes at 1,500 pike harvested or at ice out, whichever comes first. This year, things will run until ice out, which is what happens in most years. And harvest has already dropped down quite a bit each week, which is also pretty typical, because people don't like playing around too much late into April and early May anyways. As of this morning, they are at around 1,100 pike harvested. Harvest per permit fish is the highest we've seen in the last 5 years or so. At this point in the year, the number of permits issued is the third highest historically, with the first and second highest years being the last 2 years. And compared to the last 2 years, most people started fishing later this year due to weather and overflow issues early on. So I'd say most people started like a week or two later than they did last year. And then permits are valid until December 31st, but after breakup, hook and line will switch to a sport fishing gear, and so you'll need a sport fishing license to continue fishing with it. And then since we had over 750 pike caught this year in the systems fishery, Sportfish put out an announcement to limit their harvest, so the bag limit is going to be reduced to 2 fish, where one of those can be over 30 inches. And then just as a reminder, if you have a solid on a pike permit and you're not expected to fish on it during the rest of the year, please close out your permit. You can do this online, over the phone, or in person. If you do decide later on that you actually do want to keep fishing, you can always contact the office and we'll just reissue your permit. So that tends to happen for people who, you know, in December decide they want to go out. So that's all I have. And if you have any questions, just let me know.
Yeah, I've got a couple for you. Thanks, Shane. Do we have an aggregate number of pike in the area right now?
We don't. The last abundance estimate would be from 2018.
Okay. Is there a plan to get one updated?
Yeah, this came up at the Board of Fish, and we expect to have one certainly by the next Board of Fish, and hopefully it would be in the next year or two. If Andy is still on, he might know a little bit more about that. Usually Sportfish is the one who does our abundance.
Yeah, great.
2025 is the plan.
Oh.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
2026 is the board meeting, right? January 2026, so.
Right.
Yeah, Gail, how come it's not under the section of subsistence?
Sorry, Al, what did you say?
How come, you know, the survey or the analysis isn't underneath the section of subsistence instead of sport fisheries?
Is that for Andy?
Well, yeah. Andy or Shane.
Relative to sport fish, it's important, so that's why we devote time and money.
Yeah, but the priority is subsistence.
Yep.
Yeah, I don't have a good answer for you either. Sometimes it just works out that way. I mean, commercial fisheries does a lot of subsistence-related work as well.
Jimmy, you want to weigh in on that one?
Yeah, thanks. Just from, you know, I haven't worked for the Division of Subsistence for over 6 years, but as the former regional supervisor there, I am familiar with some of the history. And just as the post-season salmon surveys are done by commercial fisheries on the Yukon, the subsistence division takes that program on the Kuskokwim, and it's just been a matter of resource, you know, limited resources. And this Minto Pike Management Plan was, you know, co-developed by the Sport Fish Division and the Subsistence Division. And just as the Copper River is managed by the Division of Sport Fisheries, it's my understanding that this particular fishery is also. And so just like the Copper River,
all of those permit data and stuff are not managed by Subsistence Division. Subsistence Division has never had the human resource capacity to be able to do that more than where they do now, which is quite a bit in the southern region of the state, like Dillingham, et cetera, and then the Kuskokwim has always utilized the limited AYK resources in the budget to focus on the Kuskokwim. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Jim. Chris, you had a comment.
Hey, Shane. Yes, ma'am. Shane, you said there was some expected changes in pike harvest for sport fishery. Can you say that again for me, please?
Yeah, and this one might be a little better answered by Andy, but essentially, just by regulation, whenever the subsistence harvest gets above 750 in the CHA, the following year, in August, the remainder of the year for sport fish, they neck it down to 2 pike per day, one of which can be over 30 inches. So sport fish has already put out their announcement saying that that's what's going to be the case.
Okay. Yeah, I thought that's what I heard. Okay. I appreciate it. Thanks, man.
And I guess I do want to add on real quick to Gail's comment earlier. So it looks like they've done 6 abundance surveys ever, dating back to 1996. And this last one in 2018 had the highest pike abundance for fish 24 inches or greater that they've seen in any of those surveys. So I think that's part of why there's been a little bit of a lag between surveys. So they're not really an annual thing. It's just kind of every few years.
Okay.
And part of why there's going to be pike out there right now is because there's a lot more water in Mateo Flats than there has been historically. They're going through this kind of high water regime, and that is excellent for pike. So it's really good habitat for them right now.
So that is a perfect segue to another question I have for both of you. And Andy, your region goes, how far does it go up into the interior?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that again?
Your management region?
The Tanana River drainage.
Okay. So the question I have, because at the URSFA preseason meeting, I heard a lot of people on the Koyukuk and other places talk about how pike are getting so much bigger and eating a lot more Chinook juveniles and other juveniles and, of course, baby ducks. But they're seeing a real increase in population and in size of pike, really getting to be giant pike, and you just brought that up. So my question is, are we doing summit surveys?
No.
Is there a reason we don't do that?
On pike?
Yeah.
Well, we know they do eat other fishes. They will eat ducks. They will eat muskrat. There's also other creatures that are eating salmon. One of the things about, you know, when you think about salmon and their smolts leaving the, most of these areas, they tend to, not be in, like for instance, the Chattanooga, if the smolts are leaving in, May with the high water, the pike are in the lake spawning. So they actually don't cross paths that much, and the salmon smolt are not going to go out and spend time in the lakes. They're going to head out the river and go down into the ocean. Trying to quantify, you know, how much, you know, pike eat. Well, we could look at that, but I mean, we already know that they do eat fish. So do burbot. Other fishes will eat, you know, I watched Arctic grayling. I've grabbed them on the Chena River right when the chum smolt are coming out and, you know, you catch them and they're puking up chum salmon. So,
Right.
The quick answer is everything eats salmon.
Right, exactly.
The biggest problem right now is them when they hit the ocean, the conditions haven't proved to be very good for growing juveniles.
Right.
And I know we want to find a good reason, but pike have been around with salmon for eons. And the thing that has kind of confused and muddied the waters is that northern pike are not native to the south central drainages, but they are to the Yukon drainage. And we're talking thousands and thousands of years. The Yukon drainage was not glaciated. It always had water running through. There's probably salmon and pike in the system for a long, long time. So it's...
Yeah, Klaus is always trying to educate me on that homeostasis.
Yeah.
But what I'm hearing from people is that it's, we may be getting a tipping point, you know, in terms of this, because they're seeing pike get so much bigger. I remember catching, I caught on Beaver Creek one time, I caught a monster pike. So I don't know if that was overall, but Chris just said that you're not seeing an increase in pike size, a decrease. Is that correct, Chris?
Yes, ma'am. We are actually seeing a decrease. I think in the last 3 years, if I was to go back to my records, I think we're seeing like a 3 or 4 inch decrease in size. And it might be habitat, or it might be environmental factors, or it might even be just other people are now fishing those locations, but we are seeing a drop in size. And that would include weight as well.
Wow. I know you keep really good records. That'd be interesting seeing that.
We try. We try.
Yeah, thank you.
Gail, this is Chuck.
Yeah, Chuck. I was just going to call you. Thank you.
Okay. Hey, Andy or Shane, just before the Arctic Yukon Board of Fish meeting in January, there was some talk about looking at that 1500, trigger that closes down the subsistence fishery, using that 1500 as the summer, the trigger for the summer sport fishery, where you drop to 1/30, two fish, only 1/30 instead of the 5 fish. Are you guys still feel that way, that it could be raised up to the 1500 that for the summer trigger?
Chuck, this is Andy. So there's two management plans. One is the sport fish management plan for the Mental Flats Northern Pike, which at this time, it only allows for, if we hit 750 fish harvest, then we have to write the EO that reduces the bag limit from 5 to 2 fish, only 1/30 inches. It's happened the last 3 years in a row, and it happened once or twice previous to those few years. I can't remember what year, 2017 maybe. So with the increase in the number of permits coming out, we're almost guaranteed to exceed 750 fish each year. So de facto, we have a bag limit of 2 fish, 1/30, if that's going to be the case. The subsistence, that has its own management plan, and when it hits 1,500 fish in that from January 1st till when the fishery closes out in the spring, the subsistence fishery can be closed at 1,500 fish. So one thought is that, well, there's actually two thoughts. You could look at it as we could propose a change and just make the bag limit 2 fish, 1/30 inches. That would be basically aligning it with what's happening de facto. And the second option would then be to look at the management plan and adjust it to reduce the bag limit only when we reach 1,500 fish harvest. And so it would act at the same time as the subsistence closure, that it would be triggered at the same time, right? So those are the two main options. Obviously, anybody could submit any other proposal for any other ideas, but... regarding that trigger, we would have to look at that management plan, has to be changed. And I know from this last Board of Fish meeting, one of the issues was that we just changed the regulation a couple years ahead of time, and there were some proposals in there, and it's hard to evaluate what those changes in regulations actually did within, a year or two of them being executed. So it was allowed to, we'll have a couple more years of letting those regulations run. We will do a population survey in winter and spring of 2025 to prepare for any proposals for this fishery in the 2026 Board of Fish meeting.
Okay.
Yeah.
The harvest, the population you're seeing now, though, could it handle that?
The management plan...
1,500 being the 1,500 being the summer trigger.
Sure. The management plan right now, if you read on both of those management plans, it's, we're managing it not to exceed 20% fishing mortality. And with a population of, I think it was 16,000 over 24 inches. I don't have it right in front of me.
Okay.
20% is, you know, like 3,200 fish.
Wow.
Right.
What is the abundance of the Chena River?
The abundance of pike in the Chena River?
Yeah.
We have never executed a project like that for that. There's not that many pike in the Chena River.
Okay.
There certainly are individuals in there. It's not a prolific population.
Okay. And I have another dumb question for you, but I'll go ahead first.
Oh, yeah, that was a lot to absorb, but I guess the key thing I keyed in that last statement was is fishing mortality. Is that harvest, or is that more above and beyond harvest?
Yeah, harvest, yeah.
Okay.
As opposed to natural mortality. You
well,
know,
I didn't know if there was some, you know, hooking, you know, hooking and it gets away or hooking and release. There's mortality associated with that, so.
Yeah, no, we're looking
strictly harvest.
Yes, correct.
Well,
harvest.
Real,
go ahead, Mike.
The real problematic number there, Al, is that he said there could be 3,200 that would be killed by mishandling by fishermen, and that would have to assume that all 16,000 got caught. So let's back off of that right quick and get down to maybe a quarter of that. Just because 16,000 pike over 24 inches don't get caught in Minto every year at sport fishing.
You mean 1,500?
No. He said 3,200 were subject to mortality from sport fishing.
Oh, okay.
And that is 20%. And what I'm saying is that all of those fish that are over 24 inches are not caught. So the mortality is not ever, in any of our lifetimes, going to approach 3,200 fish.
Got it.
Okay. I've got one more question, too. Then. Okay, we're talking 3,500 then of, you know, a harvest or whatever. So are you taking the subsistence in the Chattanooga, that 1,500, and are you adding in the rest of subsistence for Minto Flats to come up with, you know, why does the 750 in just the Chattanooga subsistence harvest dictate what the summer sport fishery is when summer sport fishery takes in the whole Minto Flats, which then you've got subsistence over at Minto side, and that's not part of the Chattanooga.
Yeah, that's Chuck, I wasn't around I was probably around when they did the management plan. I just don't recall. I wasn't a part of designing the management plan and why they, I'd have to go back. I mean, we're talking years ago to go back through some of the notes to try to figure out exactly why they chose that number. I would have to dig into that, and I certainly can. Just to clarify a little bit, the management plan just says we don't want fishing mortality, in other words, harvest, to exceed 20% of the population. And that's why I was just throwing out that 3,200 is approximately 20% of 16,000. How we get to those numbers is Shane collects all the subsistence permits. Everybody has to report every week. So right now he's up at about 1,100 fish. We get the statewide harvest surveys. We utilize that for sport fish harvest. There's a little bit of a delay in that. And then any other subsistence harvest that might occur through the year, commercial fisheries records that as well. When you're looking at the total population, it's in Minto Flats. It's a bit larger than the area that we put the estimate, that 16,000 fish was for that Chattanooga River overwintering area. It's not the only area that they overwinter, but it might be the densest area in terms of population. But when you're looking at the whole system, we're talking, it's quite substantial.
Okay. That helps me understand a little bit better that you're just looking at the Chattanooga area, you know.
Yeah, that particular abundance then was just for that overwintering area that,
sure.
And, you know, start thinking about the whole flax, and that's part of the reason why we did some of the radio telemetry to figure out where some of these fish in the Chena or the Chattanooga overwintering area went. And some of them do disperse into the other areas, and I'm not going to quote a number off the top of my head because I can't remember, but, you know, a substantial part went into the Mythical Lakes area upstream in Gold Stream and the Gold Stream drainage. There's obviously other lakes and the rest of the river system, you know.
Oh. Yeah, I guess I'll just get back to that. I just don't like the idea that the whole of Mythical Flats sport fishing is dictated off the Chattanooga subsistence. When, you know, and you just said you're basing the numbers at within the Chattanooga subsistence area, that you're not taking in the rest of the flats, but you're basing the full summer sport fish for pike, it extends over the whole flats, not just the Chattanooga area.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, I will tell you this, Chuck, and everybody else, it's quite an endeavor to go out there just to get the abundance assessment just for that area. You know, and that's why, you know, there was questions about, are we checking the stomach contents of pike and, you know, whatever river, you know, and there's a lot of things we'd love to do. It's just time and money we're kind of restricted on that. Even when we look at like the Chena and Salsa Towers, we're not guaranteed to have that money every year. We're not long-term funded for those. So it's kind of an annual, and those are important projects too. So we have all these, high priorities, and it's just hard to fit everything in there the way we, you know, I'd love to know more about the pike population in Mitchell Flats. We'd love to know the actual everywhere, the whole region, and get a real population estimate across the whole region. But we can take apart, we can take some of the radio telemetry, and with that radio telemetry gives us an idea of what's going on in the rest of the flats.
You guys do good work.
Yeah. I'd love to do more. It's just, it's hard. It's hard to have the money and the personnel, you know?
Oh, I understand. Yep. Okay, yeah. So that's something to look at a management plan later on.
Yeah, no, we should talk more about this. I think, you know, it's up for discussion. This is a perfect topic for you guys to take up and think about what you think the management plan should be.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, Andy, thank you for that, because both of you, because I think that's exactly what we should do, is look at that management plan. There's going to be more and more pressure on pike as, you know, salmon resources are gone. But I have a million questions and I'll figure them out later. But the one dumb question we have is, since the Chena River is the spawning ground for eels, when do they start migrating out?
You're speaking of the lampreys?
Yeah, lamprey, right.
In the Chena River or any of these rivers in the Tanana?
In the Chena specifically.
Chena specifically, they would, based on how they travel up the Yukon, if you're speaking of the anadromous ones.
Right.
The anadromous lampreys, when they come into the lower Yukon, when you look at the rate of speed that they appear to travel from village to village, they should be at the Chena River mouth about beginning of sometime in the month of January, let's say. I do know of an individual that set a burbot line that got one of those larger anadromous lampreys wrapped up in his burbot set.
Wow.
In, I think, late January or early February, so that comports with that sort of information. I've set traps in the Chena from early February till breakup, when I had to pull the traps, and I caught not one large anadromous lamprey.
Huh.
And I think they just hang out in the river, and then they head in June into the Chena and the Chattanooga and the Salcha, the Good Pasture. The larger anadromous ones, yeah.
They spawn in the tuna, is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah. So when do the juveniles head downriver?
They live in the river for about 5 years.
Oh.
They filter feed. They grow rather slowly.
Okay, I did not know that. Okay.
Yeah, and there's some not total understanding of how they live their life cycle, but we have, to the best of my knowledge, and these are some of the publications that if you read, like in, you know, the same species in Russia, they tend to look at them more as like rainbow trout steelhead. So a small proportion of those that are spawned will smolt and go to the ocean after a few years in the fresh water. And the rest of them will do their whole life cycle within the river. So you can have adults that are only like about the size of a pencil.
Oh, yeah. Wow. And so they're obviously feeding on very small stuff.
They're filter feeding their whole life.
They're filter feeding, right. Yeah.
And when they smolt and go to the ocean, that's when they become more parasitic and they will, you know, rasp on the flesh of the fish that they attach to.
Right, yeah. When I was fishing, we would see evidence of that all the time.
Yeah.
Constantly.
The little eels, Gale, are the prey, not the predator.
That's true. That is true. Thanks. Like, yeah. Al?
Yeah, thanks, Gale. I didn't want to let Andy off with an easy question. So why do you assume that when the sport fishery, or the summertime, I'll call it, northern pike fishery in Mento Flats, why do you consider all those fish sport caught and none of them subsistence used?
Sorry, Al, can you say that again?
I'm just curious on, you know, you have the winter fishery and then you have the summer fishery. Why do you assume that residents that take in fish in the summer fishery in Northern Pike in the Mento Flats, Gulfstream area, aren't being utilized as subsistence caught fish?
Well, we, so at least from the subsistence side of things, so we have the permit and the CHA, and that, you know, might harvest up to 1,500 pike. But actually, there, a lot of people are still using their, well, I don't know about a lot of people. There are people who use their subsistence permit still for the rest of the year, because, gillnets become legal. And that component, that uses the subsistence permit harvests, like roughly the same amount as what gets harvested during the CHA, winter fishery. So there is a separate subsistence component that is occurring while the sport fishery is going on. They're just not using rod and reel.
Is rod and reel considered a means to subsistence fish in the summer?
Not there, but in some areas in the Yukon.
Okay, well, thank you both for that report. At least two more questions we'll have for you in the fall. Thank you very much. Any last questions for Andy or Shane? Jim?
Yeah, thanks. Not a question, but thanks very much, Shane and Andy. I did attach a link to it was household surveys basically in Minto that was done by Sport Fish Division and Subsistence Division in the mid-90s, and that was all part of – that was used to help develop those two – the Sport Fish Management Plan and the Subsistence Management Plan that work in tandem. So just for your information, there is more recent information from on Minto's uses. I don't have that information available to me, but I'm sure the department could bring that into bear. I mean, this is a unique situation where there actually is a subsistence management plan in place that's tied to a sport fish management plan. It was originally intended to be the first, you know, sort of as to how to develop the pilot demonstration of how the divisions would work together to develop these kinds of management plans that are much more area and species specific in order to ensure reasonable opportunities for subsistence were provided. So there would, if there was going to be like a reconsideration or reopening of the management plans, it would be, I suppose one could get changed without the other, but it's my understanding is that they were meant to work in tandem, and there's more information, like Shane said, from the 2018 population assessment, more recent subsistence harvest assessments. We do know that the Chattanooga harvest area winter fishery has affected it some of the customary and traditional use patterns in Minto Flats by Minto residents. So it would probably be good to have all that information available for the board if we were going to start to consider amendments to either or both plans. Thanks.
Thank you, Jim. Good point. I just want to point out what Dina mentioned in the chat about a large predatory lamprey eating a whole fish in the Bering Sea Trawl Survey, which, you know, when I was out on some of the bigger boats in the Bering Sea years ago on a contract, and we used to get hagfish or slime fish, but they're scary as heck. And they're like this crazy lamprey with teeth like arrowfish. And they get inside a body and they'll eat the body of anything alive from the inside out. Have you ever seen that, Dina?
No, I have not. But yeah, there's a couple ways they find their way in, and they're really gross.
They are gross. Hagfish is especially gross. And Mike's chuckling. I gotta make a sci-fi movie out of that.
This is a PG show, ladies.
That's a what?
This is a PG show. This is not, you know, just a adult only.
That's true. That's true. That is true. Sorry about that.
The guys were cooking up a plot for a horror movie there for a minute.
Yeah, I know. Okay, well, yeah, it can be, believe me. And they call them spine fish for a reason, because their enzyme is sort of like about 10,000 worse than pink salmon. Their enzymes start to work almost immediately, and you can't okay. grab a hold of them. They turn to jelly, you know. Oh, never mind. I won't go for it. It's a horror show. Anyway, so thank you. I think we're just about there. So does anybody have any last-minute questions or any comments? This is the last meeting before fall, and it's been a long, hard year. And all of you are doing great work, so I just want to give you a rah-rah, because we're all part of this equation, and it's pretty much all hands on deck right now. So any last-minute questions, comments?
No, I'll just say thanks, Gail. Thanks for all the work that you do in keeping the subcommittee running, and all the your energy level and all the products that you guys tackle and take on is really impressive and very inspiring. And if folks want to get a hold of us throughout the season, we've always got someone in the Fairbanks office, and then we'll be out in Mnemonic June, July, and August, and then also on the YIRGFA teleconferences weekly, and we'll be putting out a weekly assessment Monday or Tuesday prior to each YIRGFA conference with an update on all the assessment projects.
Yeah, that'll be great. We'll look for that. And I always watch the announcements. Of course, just a reminder that YIRGFA has those in-season calls at 1 o'clock every Tuesday throughout the season. That's a good time to catch up on how people are doing up and down the river. Yeah, and thank you, Dan. Okay. Well, I just want to wish everybody a great summer. And I will be talking with a lot of you over the summer for sure. But have a good season, have fun, stay safe, and we'll see you in the fall.
Yeah, Gail, I'll miss your meetings. It's always thought-provoking and exercises my mind, so.
Oh, good.
You should have them all summer long.
Oh, wonderful. Great.
Thanks for all your work, Gail.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you, too, Chuck, for everybody's work. Everybody here works hard.
Yep, thanks. Thanks, Al. You always work out in my mind, too.
Yep, that's the truth. That is the truth.
Have a good night.
And Kyle, thank you, and also have a great summer. You're going to have fun.
Yeah, thanks, Gail, and thanks, everyone. And, yeah, have a great summer, and I'll probably see you all again sometime in September or October, depending on when you want to meet.
Yeah, certainly hope so. And can you send me the link for this meeting so I can, over the summer, do the minutes? Okay.
Absolutely. I'm still working till Friday, so you can bug me for anything you need. So.
Okay, great. All right. Thanks, all. Have a good time.
Yeah, have a great night, everyone.
Thanks, Gail.